Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Hi, folks. Hi, my wonderful, wonderful audience around the world. The best people in the field of psychology, psychiatry, well, really everything about life, real life, the kind of real life that we folks in the mental health field like to deal with. And I also want to wish you all a very, very happy new year. I don't think it's phony or fake or trivial or silly to use the new year as a time to assess stuff. I certainly do that. I've done it. And I've actually made some good decisions this year for my own life that I'm implementing. So it's important to have a time when you do this, though, of course, as we'll be discussing, you need to do it every day of your life. Now, my guest today, Robert Wubelding, are you there, Bob?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, good. We have a good connection.
Okay, good, good.
Well, Bob's been on the show before for important reasons, and especially I wanted him for the new year. Bob's last name is spelled W-B-B-O-L-D-I-N-G. Bob's a psychologist, a counselor. He's director of the Center for Reality Therapy in Cincinnati, Ohio. And reality therapy is based on the books of William Glasser and the teachings and conferences he held before he died in 2011. I think it's fair to say that Bill Glasser and I were friends. We called each other friends. Like a lot of men, we didn't spend a lot of time together. He read my books. I read his. I endorsed his books. He endorsed mine. I invited him to conferences. He invited me to conferences. I guess that makes for pretty good friends in this day and age. One of the central things that Bill and I had in common was that even before me, because he's a bit older than I am, or he was a bit older, is that Bill refused to get involved with psychiatric drugs. And he, while he didn't go and attack them and write about them and study them like I did, I mean, who wants that miserable task? He simply said that's not the way to go. And he developed his own approach. And that got him into some degree of trouble by itself. But the most important contribution he made was to focus on choice. One of his books is called Choice Theory. One is called Reality Theory. The Reality Therapy, excuse me. And he just honed in on the idea that human beings make key choices that determine their emotional state, their success, and their lives. And what a better way, I can't imagine, to begin the new year than to have a good talk with Bob Wubelding about choice, making choices for the rest of your life and for this good new year. And today we want to talk about choice, but we also have to cover what keeps us from making good choices. What keeps us from making a choice to not make any choices? What makes us feel like we don't have any choices? Because most of the people who come for therapy really don't think that they can have good choices in their life, that they can even make good choices. And most people nowadays, because of the whole biochemical nonsense, the lies put out by the pharmaceutical empire and by psychiatry, which is just sort of the stormtroopers of the empire, what is being told to people is they don't have choices. They have mental illnesses and biochemical imbalances. So with that hearty welcome to all of my listeners on the new year and to Bob, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, Peter, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I always enjoy talking to you, and it's a joy to talk to people who are interested in these topics. So thank you, and Ginger, also your wife, for inviting me. I'm honored to be here.
And, well, that's great. We're very glad to have you.
I'd like to say that choice is kind of a not such a popular word these days, at least in the helping professions. I think it's becoming more popular, but conventionally we have said that, well, you know, the outside world kind of controls us and oppresses us and holds us back, and only the privileged few have choices. And that's a kind of a sociological concept, I think, that we see that has impinged upon the counseling world. As a matter of fact, when I talk about choice and choice theory as developed by Glasser, and then the implementation is called reality therapy, when I talk about that at conferences, sometimes people will say, you don't give enough emphasis, enough credence to the environment and the limitations that people have. And my comment is, I think we've made that point. We've certainly made the point that people's
point.
Choices are limited, you know. And I mean, if you're born and raised in Shanghai, you don't have much of a choice to wake up and speak English one day. And there are limitations to what we can choose. But in our counseling and in our therapy, it seems to me we need to stress, what do you have choices over? And most people who, at this time of the year, start to make resolutions, I would suspect they believe that they do have choices. And the trouble is, after a short time, they might abandon those. In fact, that's one of the criticisms of New Year's resolutions, is that people abandon them quickly. But I'm in favor of New Year's resolutions because it does involve choice. But it should involve making a choice for a limited amount of time and then reevaluating it. So it seems to me that choice, choosing options, possibilities, these are at the core of a better life for us. And I can quote no better source, Peter, than your book. It's called Wow, I'm an American: How to Live Like Our Nation's Heroic Founders. I'd like to give a quote. It says, when you learn to consciously choose the direction of your life based on sound principles, you will be surprised to learn how many opportunities are available to you. It seems to me that's a key principle in your book and in your philosophy, is that that when we live according to certain principles, that we discover opportunities, and then we take an excess number of drugs, whether legal or illegal, those eventually limit our choices, because, or at least they limit our perception of our choices, because they enslave us. And so our job as helpers is to help people become free, which is the same thing as opening choices for them. So that's the way I look at it.
Thank you so much for mentioning my book, Wow, I'm an American.
Yeah, it's great. It's a wonderful book.
And I actually, you know, I'm the resident psychiatrist on George Norrie's Coast to Coast, which is the largest show in the country of evening, a talk show. And when I go on every week or two, I talk to millions of people. And I chose, when he asked me to come on and talk on New Year's Day, I talked about the principles that are in Wow, I'm an American. And as the show goes on, I appreciate you bringing that up. And I may go back and pick up on some of the principles in Wow, I'm an American. And I was so enthusiastic in introducing you that I mostly talked about Bill. And I'm not sure I really gave you enough introduction.
That's okay.
Bob's
honored
the author
to be associated
with reality therapy.
Bill Glasser, because, and I want to give full credit to him. I mean, I may talk about a lot of things here, but whatever I talk about is derived and based on him and his ideas, so I want to give full credit to him.
Well, Bob's latest book is of many books, like me, many books, Reality Therapy for the 21st Century. And he writes that it's the most comprehensive book on the theory and practice, founded by William Glasser. Bob's taught reality therapy all over the world. And this is interesting to me, Asia, Middle East, North Africa, Europe. So that's very interesting to me because, I mean, one of the other things that the false bill of goods we've been sold, in addition to the fact that people don't make choices, we've been sold the bill of goods that human beings don't really have the same aspirations around the world. And I do think that our founding fathers came up with some principles of freedom and personal responsibility and gratitude for what we're given, and that they tried to be loving people. I think they came up with principles that are universal. So, you know, one of the things maybe I'd like to just go to right now, Bob, is ask you, with all your teaching around the world, much more exposure than I've had closely to people from a variety of cultures, what is your idea about, you know, human nature? Do you think that given the slightest chance, people aspire for freedom and to take charge of their lives?
I think that's true everywhere. We used to speak about the revolution of rising expectations years ago in the 60s and around the world, that the expectations of people were rising, and what they wanted was freedom and choices. And so the question is, what do you do with those choices when you have them? And how do you get them? But it seems to me that at least wherever I go, that's something that's very common, that people, that's why they respond to the theory and method that we teach, which is reality therapy based on choice theory. And because you just assume people have choices, no matter how bleak their situation may be, they have choices. If you examine the work of, for example, of Viktor Frankl, who spent 3 years at Auschwitz in a Nazi concentration camp, and he wrote this marvelous book called Man's Search for Meaning, and he says that the most basic drive that people have is to have purpose and meaning in their lives, and when people lost that in those diabolical situations, he says those are the people that didn't survive it. And I mean, this is a generalization. It's not true in every case. But he said those who could see that they had some choice, those are the ones that survived. And he said that he had the choice as to how he would perceive this oppression. And he would perceive it, he chose to perceive it as having meaning and purpose. And he was released after this horrendous world in which he lived and became a world-famous psychiatrist. And he was a wonderful man. I met his grandson, and I know him a little bit. He lives in Vienna, and he has a documentary on him where people around the world make comments about Viktor Frankl, and they talk about his emphasis on choosing their people, on people choosing their plight, choosing their fate, and making choices wherever they live and in whatever circumstances they are either condemned to live or have the opportunity to live. We have more choices in Western civilization and especially in the United States, of course, but not everybody even in these cultures think they have choices. And of course, some have more than others, but our job as helpers is to open possibilities for them. And one of the questions I've always asked people is, if you had a lot of choices, what would you be doing this afternoon? That's different than what you would have done if you have not come in here to see me. And they'd say, well, I'd be doing this, I'd be doing that. And almost always they come up with things that they could do. And so I say, how about doing it? Why not just do it? You know, I'd call a friend, I'd take a walk, I'd I'd go to the library. I'd, you know, look for a way to protect myself, whatever it may be. Well, what's stopping you from doing it? And then what are some external forces that are stopping you, and what are some internal forces? And almost invariably, the internal forces can be dealt with fairly easily if you just, when we say, okay, how about doing it today? How about right now? How about practicing it right now? So I think we open up choices to people all the time in our help that we give them. And we can do this regardless of what they, of their circumstances. I know your mission is to deal with the drugs. Now, I'm not a psychiatrist, so when I counsel with somebody, I don't say very much about prescription drugs at all. I say talk that over with your doctor, because I don't want to be accused of practicing medicine. And so even though I might have private opinions about it, I keep those to myself. But I'd say, you know, if you're a medical person, that's a different story.
The whole idea of choice is wrapped around with the issue of responsibility. So I wanted to add a couple of thoughts about that, because the R word, responsibility, is probably even more dealt with as a bad word in modern times, politically and psychologically, than is choice, which is a more abstract word. I heard Viktor Frankl talk in the 1960s in a fairly big university amphitheater in Washington, D.C. I think it would have to have been the late 60s. And somebody from the audience stood up and said, well, you know, what are we supposed to do facing annihilation, you know, in the Cold War from an atomic bomb going off? And Frankl said, we have to take responsibility for our own individual lives.
Yeah.
And that resulted in groans, audible groans,
really,
from the audience. Now, move ahead to just a few years ago when I'm speaking to a college audience about these various issues involving psychiatric drugs. And I get into some into the politics at the same time. And I say, well, you know, what we all must do is take responsibility for ourselves. And so help me God, I got audible groans from throughout the audience of college students. So one of the reasons why, folks, Bob and I want to talk about these issues and invite you on the new year to be thinking about them, is there are great forces out there, political, psychological, Bob mentioned sociological, telling us that we shouldn't think that we can take responsibility for our lives. We shouldn't want the freedom to do so. And we shouldn't imagine that we can make choices even when we are struggling with deprivation and with oppressive forces. And one of the things that has struck me from, you know, knowing people who have come from very oppressive circumstances and knowing people who have been through very poor circumstances and reading their work and listening to them on TV and so on, is that even under the most dire circumstances, some folks, for example, raise their children, even if it's a single mother, while she's working full time, raise their children with a sense of responsibility. And some, maybe not all of those children, become very responsible, self-determining human beings. And I believe that it is true around the world, regardless of the culture. So if, going back in history a little bit to, cultures that were pre-industrial, during the evolution of humanity, we were only a couple of hundred thousand years into being more or less Homo sapiens. Nobody knows exactly where to draw the line, but it's quite recent. People certainly had a different idea about values. And this is still true in some cultures today. I'm sure their values were all around the family unit, because we were nomads. That's how we evolved as nomadic extended families. I write about this in Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, the implications for us now. And as nomadic people, we were very deeply involved in the relationships within our families for survival. And from what we know about contemporary societies that are pre-industrial, which have been studied a lot, while the individual in many ways places the society and the family as the center of his values, rather than the individualism of Western society, the individual nonetheless makes choices, acts heroically, and maybe even more heroically and more responsibly than we might ordinarily act in Western society, because he's acting not just on behalf of himself, but as I believe people should, and I'm sure Bob does, he wouldn't do the work he's doing, on the behalf of others. So even where cultures may put a different emphasis, people who contribute to their families and cultures have to take responsibility, have to believe in choice making, and have to have the freedom to do so. And in fact, one last thought about this, because I've never quite unraveled this, and folks who are listening, never quite unraveled it in this fashion. If you look back on evolution, as again, I look back on, and I draw a lot on Darwin, because Darwin was very much in agreement with the role of choice-making and values in human life. He's been really sold short by the same people who don't want you to believe in freedom and responsibility. They don't want you to actually read Darwin. They want to tell you that Darwin was a determinist when he was not.
That's right.
So I have a little section about that at the end of my Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety book. But the point is that human beings always have made choices, have always taken pride in being responsible, have always wanted to make real contributions to culture. The values of the culture may change and do change, but human beings are tremendously interdependent. And in the past, we've been even more interdependent now, and that's one of our problems, is we're so isolated now, and I would say pseudo-independent. I'd call it non-dependent rather than really independent now, because real independence, I think, occurs in a tendency, in a concept of being close with other human beings. So as far back as we go, we're going to find human beings caring about other human beings, but making choices in that context. Let me take a breath and let you talk some more, Bob.
Well, I think just building on what you said, I think we can say that altruism, doing things for other people, is closely connected with mental health. And one of the things that can enhance our mental health is getting lost in the world of other people and doing things for them. And I mean, there's plenty of evidence to that effect. I'm reading a book now called Rewire Your Brain by John Arden. He also wrote a book called The Brain Bible. And he talks in there about the importance of doing things for other people. And we would say in reality therapy that this satisfies a deep need inside of us for belonging or for affiliation or for connectedness, or for love. And so figuring out how to satisfy that need in a healthy way, which one way, of course, is doing things for other people, that's a choice that we have, and it leads to better spirituality, better mental health, and a happier life. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to follow up on the evolution theme is that we actually had more freedom as we evolved than we do today. And that's not romanticizing. And it's very important because it shows that human nature was built for freedom. When we lived in groups of 25 or 30 people, men, mostly men, made their own weapons. They participated in hunting as they wished, generally speaking. We know that from indigenous tribes. But they made their own clothing. Men probably made their own clothing. Women made their own clothing. Families cooked their own meals and shared within the extended.
You there, Peter?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I think we got cut off or something happened for a moment there.
Oh, okay. But well, you're okay now.
Yeah,
so
fine.
If,
I got it.
If a person, if a family or a person's felt like they were being bullied by a leader, if somebody tried to take over and be a chief, there was no concept of chiefs at that point because it couldn't happen in that way. They were just wise people. Now, if a chief tried to take over, somebody tried to bully, why, you could just pick up with your wife and your two kids or three kids, there weren't huge families, and leave, and you could survive because you could hunt on your own, you could fish on your own, you could gather on your own, you could make your own clothing and your own weapons. So we had huge freedom there. And then the individual groups that moved about and supported each other had huge freedom. So freedom is a deep part of the human experience. And then with it comes that responsibility of hunting within the group to be able to take down a mammoth, the responsibility of the women going out together to, in order to protect themselves and to do the best job and take care of the kids when they're gathering. So we've always been folks who live by freedom and responsibility, and that's been seriously compromised as we've developed these large governments, large societies, complex communities. And I think the more we can carve out and find ways to carve out areas of community where we are free to relate as we want, the better off. So look for organizations that you can relate to and have experiences with, or do what Bob Wobeding and I have done, you know, create your own organizations to gather people around you. Do things that are going to give you the freedom to do more of what you want while you have relationships with people. And the new technology just makes that so much more possible. Many of us have a community around the world like we never could have had in the past. So these are very concrete things that you can think about in the coming year. Bob, what about talking about the stuff that gets in the way of our making choices and taking responsibility and being grateful for what we have and finally becoming a source of love? Those are the four principles of my book, Wow, I'm an American, that we protect freedom, that we take responsibility at all times, that we show gratitude for whatever higher power we believe in, from nature to God or whatever, and that we show gratitude for this life, and that finally we become a source of love. How would you begin discussing or thinking about with yourself, your clients, with us today, what gets in the way of people? We've talked about some of the influences from outside. What are the internal machinations that keep us from believing in that? Because I think they're the same thing as, quote, mental illness. I think what if there's any notion of there being some validity to self-destructiveness, it's from these internal blocks to our pursuing freedom, responsibility, gratitude, and love.
Now, I think let me backtrack a minute, Peter, and just say a comment about responsibility itself. I think it does, as you said, takes on a political meaning, and sometimes it seems to me that people equate that with accusing people and blaming them. Like people, we say, "Well, you're responsible for your behavior," and then we say, I think mistakenly, we blame them and criticize them and put them down for the past. But like in the world of recovery from addictions, one of the themes is they're responsible for their future, but not for the past. So quit blaming yourself or there's expressions that 12-step programs have about that, but you're responsible in the sense of you have some choices. So, what do I think the obstacles are? Well, in some ways, I think the obstacles are that we think it's, we have to make grandiose choices. And this is what why I think actually New Year's resolutions can be useful if we know how to make them and if we plan in some ideas other than to say, well, I'm going to lose weight or I'm going to do such and such. These are kind of grandiose things, but the plan should be more specific. And when we make a plan, when we choose a realistically doable plan, how about planning to evaluate that, say, in 2 weeks, in a month or whatever? People live an entire life of serenity in recovery from the philosophy, just for today. Just for today, I will live through this day only and not try to solve the problem of life at once. And there's a whole range of just for todays. And they live 30 years of sobriety or 50 years of sobriety based on a very short-term plan. So I think the freedom that we have can be expressed in short-term plans. I'll give you a personal example. My New Year's resolution is to use little time snippets that come up during the day to use them more profitably. Now, not to use every one, but to use two or three a day. And because it's a little bit impossible to use your time 100% efficiently all the time, but just a few times a day would be sufficient. So now I made that same resolution last year, but I don't regard that as a failure. I regard that as a sign of determination, of perseverance. So when a person doesn't follow through on their plans to connect with other people, to in whatever myriad of ways that are available to them, I think that's not a reason for looking back with guilt, but it's a reason for saying I'm responsible for the future and I'm going to make a realistic plan, make a realistic choice, and accept responsibility for it. I'm either going to do it or I'm not going to do it, and then when I don't do it, okay, I'm responsible. Now let's move on. So I think that's a healthy way to make plans and to make to use our freedom. And usually, and it's very healthy, not usually, it's always very healthy to use it in connection with other people. I'm going to use my time, for example, better one night a week to spend a night with my wife going out on a date or something like that. These are realistically doable plans for most people, and they're very strength providing. A person can really feel strength. And especially if they do something new, something different, something more novel. There's a physiological basis to this. It's like two people when they're in love. I mean, their brain really lets loose with the healing and endorphins, I guess you'd call them. And as the time goes by, then they kind of cool off. But at the same time, when they think of new ways to do things, connect with each other, they feel that love just as strong as they did. So I think a lot of the obstacles are internal to us. And again, this is not to blame people. It's just to say, what are they? And what can I do about it today? Today, I think a realistic choice is called SAMIC, S-A-M-I-C. The plan or the choice should be simple, not complicated. It should be A, attainable, realistically doable. It should be M, measurable, like when will you do it? And it should be I, immediate. How about today? How about tonight? And then it should be C, controlled by the planner. Oh, I'll do this if somebody else does that. When I worked at a halfway house for women ex-offenders, they used to say, well, I'll get a job. They used to say, to the unemployment office if the staff wakes me up. And we used to say, well, there's two things here. Number one, it's not the unemployment office, it's the employment office. Because you already know how to be unemployed, now we want to help you become employed. And secondly, what will you do if the staff doesn't wake you up? So are you able to get up on time by yourself? So the plan should be, and the choice, empowering choice, should be a choice that's controlled by the person. Now, a lot of choices are somewhat dependent on other people, of course. That's why I said the plan should be I'll look for a job, not I'll find a job. So that's just a suggestion that I think is pertinent to planning and to the idea of choice making and the idea of freedom. The idea is to help people make a choice that they feel free to do. A lot of people don't feel free to do a lot of things, but what do you feel free to do? And I think the idea is to start with that individual person and not kind of impose it on him from the outside. But as I said, these are universal ideas. These are not just limited to the Western culture. Maya Angelou once said, she loved to say this constantly, she said, we have more in common than we have that separates us. And as human beings, I can say that this is, I from my experience, which is, of course, just mine, and other people's too, is that these ideas apply, the idea of choice and freedom and responsibility apply quite well in Japan. If any culture produces people who are responsible, you'd say that culture does. And the same way in Korea and Singapore. They want to be free of a lot of external restraints as well as figuring out how to use their own power and ability more effectively. So it seems to me those are some of the obstacles, and that's a way to handle it, is to say, what can I do? What can I do that's realistically doable today? So you can see, Peter, I try to teach ideas that are very practical to people. And
this is so interesting
drugs, okay,
to talk about.
Well,
we think our minds and our
drugs.
Work probably looks a little different because of the, it's just a personality difference. I was just, but maybe not. So let me tell you what I was thinking about.
Yeah.
And I've never shared this quite so much on in public before. But I'm thinking back on what are the decisions I remember making that were life transforming for me. And I remember one that I made in probably 1966 or 7 when I was at the National Institute of Mental Health. I remember two very different kinds, but I actually remember them. One was a more obvious kind of decision, which was I was asked if I wanted to become a career officer. I was at NIMH for 2 years. It also served as my Army time. I was an officer in the United States Public Health Service, lieutenant commander or captain. And then the 2 years were up, and I was asked to come and to stay at NIMH in the children's section, and I agreed.
Mm-hmm.
And then very quickly or shortly after I realized, no, my life – now, I wasn't a reformer at this point. I had all the same views, but I wasn't an activist. And I said to myself, no, I don't want to be in a bureaucracy. I don't want to, have that life. I'm going to take this huge risk and find something else to do out there in the big world now that I've got, I'm a fully qualified psychiatrist and I finished my 2 years with the National Institute of Mental Health. And that was a big deal. I ended up taking a job, kind of created consultantship, which was another huge choice, where I was working with sensitivity groups.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't like it. I thought they were oppressive. I made another big choice. And I went into private practice, which I'd never planned to do. And then I remember choices that were emotional. I want folks to think about this, because you can really make major choices. This is a few years before I got together with Ginger, so I'm a really mature man by then, in my 40s. I remember feeling angry a lot of the time. I was doing a lot of reform work. That made me angry all the time because I was witnessing these horrific atrocities and trying to change them and trying to deal with it. And it was, I was an angry young reformer.
Yeah.
And I actually and I went to an AA meeting. It's funny that AA is coming up, with a friend of mine who was an alcoholic. It's a woman I was actually dating. She wasn't drinking anymore. So I went to an AA meeting with her. And when I came out, I was really impressed with this notion of giving up to God, which you can't handle. And I think I probably read about it some. And I gave up my anger to God. I decided that I just couldn't be angry at all the psychiatrists in the world. I couldn't be angry at all the pharmaceutical industries in the world. I was going to do my, because that was going to wear me down and I'd never be a reformer and I'd be miserable. So I literally said, with my frail faith at the time, "Dear God, I cannot handle my anger. If there's somebody who really needs to be blasted with anger, would you do it for me? I can't live this way." And from that moment on, I began working really hard on letting go of anger. So there are larger decisions and psychological decisions that you can also make. I think there's just so many ways we approach decision making, and I'd be happy for your feedback on that, Bob.
Yeah, I think so. I think I think the idea is to look inside and say, what do I need to do positively, even if I'm an angry person? What do I need to do, and how do I need to act as if I'm not angry, as if I don't have problems? What do I need to do, and then let's do them. And I have this idea of if you want to be rich, find out what rich people do and do it. And So, take a rich person to lunch and ask them what they do. So the same thing is true here. And what people do is they figure out ways to satisfy those needs, the need for belonging or a connectedness, the need for feeling a sense of inner control. And I would ask that person, what do you do when you feel a sense of inner control? What do you do for fun? That's always one that's overlooked in the mental health world is fun. It's kind of superficial, you know, and yet it's really not. And it's hardly superficial, because when people have fun, that releases different, and their brain makes different connections. There's plenty of physiological evidence to that effect. And laughing isn't just a concept. As the best medicine isn't just a slogan in Reader's Digest, there's a profound truth to that. And Victor Borge once said the shortest distance between two people is a laugh. So
that's cool.
it's a way to connect with people. And so as well as then, of course, more explicitly, choices. So it seems to me those five components of, I didn't mention the first one, survival or self-preservation, and then belonging and power or inner control and fun or enjoyment and freedom or independence. These are avenues that people can follow to gain better mental health and to let go of some of their problems, let go of their depression, let go of their anger, let go of their guilt, their shame. And
let's talk about that some, because I think that one of the most important things is to not ever be guided by guilt, shame, or anxiety in your decisions. And this is a real key for me.
Yeah.
It's the center of my book about guilt, called Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. I believe that we should make all of our decisions based on love and reason and ethics, so that we make decisions not because we feel bad,
yes,
or guilty, not because we feel that we've done something shameful or humiliating, and not because we're driven by anxiety, and similarly, not by the derivatives of guilt, shame, and anxiety, which are just getting numb and getting angry. So one of the most important things you can do, folks, in the new year is every time you get ready to take an action, because if you didn't, you would feel guilty, or if you didn't, you would feel ashamed, or if you didn't, you would feel anxious, don't take the action. Or in the same vein, if you're driven by anxiety to do something, don't do it. If you're driven by guilt or shame to do something, don't do it.
Yeah.
Now, what people say when they hear this is, well, if we got rid of all guilt, then people would be horrible to each other. No, I don't think so. But anyway, you don't have to be miserable to people if you give up guilt. So you don't have to go that route personally. go the route of figuring out what is a loving thing to do, what's going to make me happy, make other people happy, what is going to contribute, not the guilt issue, not about pain, not about your painful emotions, about your positive ones. And it can become very complicated because caring can be very muddled by guilt.
Yeah.
And the taking care of yourself can be very muddled by your anxieties. But look for what, to me, love is a happiness. It's a feeling of joy. Look for what looks joyful, what looks interesting, what looks exciting, what looks right in terms of a solid morality. I deeply believe, as Bob does, in contributing to the world, obviously, or I wouldn't take such huge risks and devote so much time to what I do. But do it because you believe in it, not because you feel guilty if you don't do it. Find what looks like is your calling on a larger level, because I do believe people have callings. Bob, you act like a man with a very large calling in terms of reality therapy. Look for what might be your calling. There are many women whose calling is raising children, but they feel embarrassed by it because of some current viewpoints.
Yeah.
Adopt your calling. Do your calling.
I like this acronym that John Arden talks about, FEED, F-E-E-D. And it kind of builds on what you just said, Peter, to don't make decisions out of shame and guilt, but find something more positive. And focus, the F is focus on something. Now, I've chosen to focus on reality therapy, to teach it, to practice it, to bring it to other people, and thereby preserve the legacy of William Glasser. Now, that's a focus. And then the E is to do something that takes effort. Maybe it's difficult to do it, whatever you're doing. Somebody wants to get exercise, focus on walking, focus on stationary bikes, focus on whatever it may be in their exercise program, and make sure it takes some effort. And then the second E is do it until it's effortless. So for me, for example, to teach reality therapy is pretty effortless. I enjoy it, and it's very, very easy for me to do this. And then the D is to do it with determination. So to stick with it when the going gets rough. And so when you're tempted to not exercise, when you're tempted to blow up at somebody at home or at work or socially, when you decided you were going to try to love them, and do it with determination even when you fail. And because we do fail. And so I thought that acronym is very useful. F-E-E-D. So focus on something, do it, especially if it takes effort, and then do it till it's effortless. And to do it with determination. Even if you fail, start again. And don't look back. So I think that kind of builds on what you said is, it's a way to make a choice, is to select something that's realistically doable and make a plan. So if I were to talk to the audience here tonight, I would say, how about making a plan to read one of Peter Bregan's books? Starting tonight. I used to tell my graduate students, even if it's a class that went from like 7 to 9:30, I said, I'd like you to take one of the textbooks tonight and make a plan. Make a plan to read one page. One page tonight. And that's all. Don't read any more. Well, if you say don't read any more, they're sure to read more. But a realistically doable plan, focusing on something concrete that takes effort to read late at night, and then later on it'll become effortless. At least it won't be quite as effortful, and then do it with determination. So that's my suggestion for making choices, is to find especially connection with other people, and to do that, a realistically doable plan. So good place to start this book that's right in front of me here. Wow. I'm an American, and that applies to people around the world. It's, it could apply, the material in there could apply to anybody.
Well, the founders were very, of this country, I mean, they pledged their lives because once they signed the Declaration of Independence, they provided a list to King George for who to hang, quite literally. And they knew that. They knew that this was the list that King George would use for hanging all of them, quite literally. And some of them were wealthy, many of them were wealthy, and they didn't have to go this direction. They didn't have to do this.
Yeah,
King George
right.
wasn't threatening their wealth. And some of them did things that weren't very, very good, but that's a complex thing about human nature. Bob, you're in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Yes.
Do you still have a practice, or are you mostly traveling and teaching?
Well, I see somebody every once in a while, not very often. I want to keep my hand in it, but I do a lot of traveling. I was at the brief therapy conference put on by the Milton Erickson Foundation, and my wife and I went there about 2 weeks before Christmas. And then I'll be in Colorado Springs and Clearwater, Florida the next month, and then back to, we're going to a conference in Finland, and we were in Seoul, Korea, and Japan, and Germany, and anyway, we get around, but it's great to do it, and so I don't do a lot of private practice, but I do a lot of teaching, because I've kind of been a teacher all my life. I was a high school history
teacher. So you won't turn people away if they sound like
the
nice folks to work with?
Now?
Yeah.
Or
are you
when?
Open to seeing new patients?
Oh, no, I don't see very many, but
okay.
The ones I
okay.
do are, you know, they're just regular
And what's
people.
Your website?
Pardon me?
Folks?
I didn't hear you.
Your website.
Oh, yeah, okay, good, thank you. It's realitytherapywub.com. Reality Therapy Wub, the first three letters of my name, W-U-B, as in Baker, .com. And my most recent book is published by American Psychological Association. It's a short 160-page book called Reality Therapy, Theories of Psychotherapy. But I don't want anybody to be scared off by the title, because it's written in English. It's not written in psychobabble. And
yeah,
American
that was
Counseling
another idea
Association
that,
is publishing another book this spring, American Counseling Association. And
what
that'll
is that
be on self-evaluation, helping people self-evaluate their own behavior and then make a plan to do something better.
Do you have any grandiose? You were teasing before, you were serious, don't make grandiose plans. Do you have any really big ones coming up? Or do you plan to pretty much go as you're going?
Oh, well, I'm going to keep going as I'm going. I lived in Germany for a year, and I lived in Japan for a year teaching on military bases, U.S. military bases. And I always have it in the back of my mind to do that again, but that's going to be pretty hard. But that would be a wonderful experience for me to have, and my wife to go with me. She loves to travel. And so that's remotely possible, but probably not. And but I want to keep writing. I got a couple more books in my head that I'd like to publish, and I like to publish journal articles too, because you can publish those and it doesn't take forever to write it. So
I think it's so important, folks, to have a happy new year for yourselves is to be like Bob and do things you want to do. One of the great secrets to life is to have things that you enjoy when you wake up in the morning.
Yeah.
If you wake up in the morning and you don't enjoy the people you're living with, if you wake up in the morning and you don't enjoy the idea of going to work, if you come home in the evening and it isn't like a pleasure, start assessing how you can make your life better at home or work, or make important choices about it. Because it is possible still in America today to choose to do all kinds of interesting, wonderful, and worthwhile things. And in fact, the world will always be so wanting of people being helpful to each other that there's always an enormous space to fill for any human being. And in terms of being helpful to other human beings and caring about other human beings. And it can be, it's just in so many ways, from, you know, volunteering at a soup kitchen to teaching children to read better or do their math better, or to enjoying nature. I mean, it's just infinite what we can do out there that's worthwhile for us and for other people. So
I always encourage people, Peter, take a walk. They come to me for counseling, and I say, when was the last time you took a brisk walk? And it could be, and almost a lot of them say, well, it's been a long time. So I say, that's a place to start, to get that those brain cells working and those neurons firing and connecting with each other. And there's a Danish philosopher and theologian, Kierkegaard, who said, there is no problem too great that it cannot be solved by walking. So I thought that's...
Well, John Adams, our second president, said one of my most favorite things, which is move or die. I mean, he lived to be a ripe old age. Outlived
like
a lot of his contemporaries. Move or die. He walked a great deal.
See?
And
yeah.
I was actually thanking my Shetland sheepdogs, my two little Shelties, because of them, even though we're in upstate New York, doesn't matter what the weather is, I walk them.
Yeah.
And I like to walk them often enough so that they're comfortable, because they're very good dogs. And they'll go to extremes not to, you know, make a mess in the house. So I try to walk them often as I can and take them for longer walks at least than I might ordinarily. And so those little Shelties keep me moving. And I think that's very, very, very important to my health. So I'm 100% in agreement with you on that. We'll be drawn to a close in about 3 or 4 minutes. There's so much more we could talk about in the future. And I'm going to have you back again, you know, as the year goes on. Because I think you have a lot of very good and practical ideas. You're in many ways a more practical man than I am. I sit and listen to these practical ideas, and I think, gee, I should be giving my clients more practical ideas, because obviously
I think you're an inspirational person, and that's kind of precedes everything.
I didn't hear what you just said. Repeat that.
I said you're an inspiration, and that precedes all the practical things that we can come up with. They go hand in hand.
Yes, they do, and I'm sure you're very inspiring to the folks you work with. I do think that how we are really either lifts up people around us or takes people down. That's another thing. I would advise folks for the new year, if you don't have a resolution, would be to greet everybody you meet the way the Quakers do. Greet that of God in them. Greet them with pleasure.
Yeah, good
greet
idea.
Them with joy. You
good
were saying,
idea.
Bob, you were – go ahead.
What?
All right, I thought you were going to say something.
That's okay. I know one thing I could say. After you make a plan and you do something, ask yourself, what was the best thing about it? What was the best thing? Not how was it, how did it go? What was the best thing about it? So that you have to give yourself a positive answer.
Well, and that's another very important thing, is to get, I really believe in, as Bob was suggesting earlier, in forcing yourselves, myself, to act as if I'm a good guy.
Yes.
As if I don't have a lot of guilt. As if I'm not ashamed. As if I'm not anxious. To act as if the way I want to be. And by God, you do that enough and you gradually find yourself getting in the shape you want to be, because you're acting as if. But listen, so folks, when you go out there in the coming hours and days, greet the folks around you with a big smile. You go into a diner, say hi. Learn what people are thinking. Be kind. Be gentle. It'll be a much better new year for you. Thank you, Robert Wubbolding, Wubbolding. And it's wub.com. A good new year to you, Bob, and to everybody else out there.